The scholar Joanna Brooks has a new book where she makes this case that Christianity, American Christianity, has played a significant role in white supremacy. She says time after time, when they could have gone out on a limb for their black brothers and sisters, when they could have spoken out against slavery and racism, white Christians mostly chickened out, picked their own self-interest instead. In the book, she says, there were these moments that flash up throughout this history, moments when these white Christians could have chosen differently. And it was often in the early days of a particular faith when there's this excitement, new ideas, charismatic leaders, and it all seems like they're going to teach and do something new and different about how to treat people of color. But then they don't. Because, Brooks argues, they get established and they get comfortable, and there are just too many risks in big, bold ideals. The book is focused on the Mormon experience, and to illustrate her point, she tells the story of Kwaku Walker Lewis.
Kwaku Walker Lewis lived in Boston, Massachusetts. He was a strong, committed member of that city's storied black emancipationist community. His parents had consciously named him after an African ancestor. He participated in the Underground Railroad. He had a barber shop, and his North Star was freedom and freedom for black people. Now, somehow in 1843, Walker Lewis encounters LDS missionaries. And he chooses to become a member of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. So Walker Lewis is moving very comfortably in Mormon circles in Boston. He is recognized as a contributing member of the community. Even Brigham Young calls him one of the best elders in the church. He belongs. He fits. And he feels it. It's difficult to know from surviving records why Kwaku Walker Lewis joined the church. But he was a man who knew his own mind. And he heard something. Something that sounded to him like freedom. And something he heard made him want to go west to see if he could establish with this community a place where none would hurt or make afraid. He was going to go build Zion. But what he found instead when he arrived in Utah was a state that was just about to legalize slavery, the enslavement of black people. Lewis arrives in Salt Lake City in October 1851. In January 1852, Brigham Young goes on the record with the Utah Territorial Legislature, making very odious statements about the place of not just black people, but all people of color in the territorial theocracy that he was proposing to build.
Inasmuch as we believe in the Bible,
inasmuch as we believe in the ordinances of God, in the priesthood and the order and decrees of God, we must believe in slavery.
Brigham Young was very responsive to desires by prominent converts from southern states that they be able to bring their slaves and keep them as slaves in this world that the Mormons were building, and that it would be a world where, in Brigham Young's words, white men would bear rule over all others.
This colored race have been subjected to severe curses, and until the curse is removed by him who placed it upon them, they must suffer under its consequences. I am not authorized to remove it. I am a firm believer in slavery.
And that happens in January 1852, and within a few months, Walker Lewis is gone. He emigrates back to Lowell, Massachusetts, and lives until his death to tuberculosis in 1856. Those of us who know and love Mormonism can understand the appeal of early Mormon theology to Walker Lewis. the idea that God dwells in intelligence, that this life and all of creation is about progress, growth, development, and expansion, that we are to be bound to one another in communities where people can live together in fellowship. That all spoke to him, but it wasn't what was happening. There was a moment when the saints could have made good on that vision. It would have cost them securing and holding territory, establishing a government that would be powerful enough to realize this theocratic vision. That required major accessions to the structures of power. And those structures of power, from the beginning of the United States, have been calculated and arrayed against the life chances of Black people. We went with it, despite what we said we believed.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, Joanna Brooks is joining us to talk about her new book. It's called Mormonism and White Supremacy. And it's something she's been working on for years. It just so happened, though, that it came out at this moment, when the country is exploding in anger and asking difficult questions about racism. Brooks didn't intend it to play out this way, but the timing of this book was perfect.
I date it back to when I walked into my freshman orientation at Brigham Young University in the basement of the JKHB, and who welcomed me was Eugene England, walks into a basement classroom and writes on the chalkboard, 2 Nephi, the verse from 2 Nephi that says, "All are likened to God, black and white, bond and free, male and female." And it was such a relief to see those words written by someone in a position of authority, because like many LDS people, I had been ashamed and had no better story for how we had treated Black people. It comes from years of study and reading books by African-American authors, studying under African-American dissertation advisors, making many mistakes, learning from and being held accountable by Black LDS people when I have made mistakes. It's been a long, long time coming. The book, when I finally sat down to write it, I wrote it in 3 months. It just kind of, it was ready to happen. And due to just various delays and accidents, it came out now. At this coincident moment with a national discussion that's long, long overdue. So I'm grateful to be part of it. And if this book can help, may it do so. But I need to credit many, many people who come before me who did this work before me.
You say you want the book to create soul searching. What do you mean?
I think the verb was instigate.
Yeah, it was instigate.
And I mean it.
That's a more active verb, is what you're saying. Like, this is important.
Yeah.
To you.
Yeah. I would like to make people uncomfortable. Not opportunistically, but because until white people, white identified people like me become uncomfortable with our own history and our roles in it, and realize that comfort is ignorance and it's not growth. It's not growth, and it suffocates us. I want it to set off conversations, because white people need to have these conversations. We need to take responsibility for a legacy system of which we've been the primary beneficiaries. We have not earned justly the comforts we wake up with, and we need to get straight about that.
Let's define our terms. What do you mean by white supremacy?
Right. And thank you for that, because I've been trained, my scholarly training is in ethnic studies, among other fields. And there's a specialized language we use, a specialized language scholars use to describe racial dynamics in the United States. Most of us, when we hear the words white supremacy, we think of the most extreme examples. We think of you know, the Ku Klux Klan, or we think of people marching in Charlottesville with tiki torches. What scholars mean when we use the term white supremacy is a system of laws, institutional practices, culture, belief that contribute to the untimely death of Black people. And by that, I mean that if you are born with melanated skin, you are statistically more likely to die young than you are if you are born with pale skin and are white identified, right? Huge disparities in life expectancy, educational attainment, family wealth, which is not the same as family income, right? Intergenerational wealth transfers, huge disparities that correlate with one's racial identification. And so white supremacy is the entire system of opportunities and alliances and networks that realize that outcome.
One of the things you write early on is you say, look, it's easy to see torches at Charlottesville that you just mentioned. It's not easy to look at, as you say, our Sunday meetings and see how over time they've conditioned us to accept Black death and suffering by other peoples of color. Talk right. about what you mean by the role now American Christianity has played in all of this, because this is the essence of what you're getting at.
Right.
What do you mean by that?
So, and it's important because my book is, it focuses on, it offers up Mormonism as an example, but yeah. this is not limited to Mormonism.
Right.
From the 18th century, if not before, no, yeah, from the beginnings, religion, Christianity in America has been a segregated business. We look back to early churches in Philadelphia, where Richard Allen and Absalom Jones, two African-American men, were pulled off their knees during prayer and, you know, removed to a gallery reserved for people of color, and later went on to found the AME Church. That, you know, Dr. Reverend Martin Luther King said that Sunday at 10 a.m. was the most segregated hour in American society. We see, if we look at our history, not just the history of Mormonism, but the history of many, many mainline Christian denominations, especially those that institutionalize and become successful, we see choices over time that make Christian churches, some Christian churches, less hospitable to Black people. In fact, absent of open commitment to Black emancipation, they become vessels for the propagation of white supremacy. They're places where well-intentioned white people can go to feel good, to feel that they are right, to feel that they're safe, to feel a sense of security and approval. Many of the rituals of white American Christianity, you know, sacralize whiteness itself as, you know, a color of holiness, are many, many theologies of mainline Protestant churches in the U.S. And Mormonism as well have emptied out our notion of sin, our theology of sin. So, you know, centuries ago, sin would have been understood as a general human condition. We are all born into sin, and through Jesus Christ and a covenant with a redeemed community, one can begin to collectively do the work to transcend sin. But in the 19th century, that rich, rich idea was pretty much evacuated and left us with the idea of sin as we have it today, which is you did something wrong. You stole a cookie from the cookie jar. You slept with someone who's not your spouse. You said a bad word. You didn't go to church on Sunday. And we've lost that deeper, more compelling moral accountability that would have prepared us to take stock of the enormous, the enormity of white supremacy as a system, and its deadly effects.
Accountability is a big word for you. It seems like the idea of taking responsibility, and we'll get to this in a minute, but the Mormon Church's inability, I think, would be your perspective and others' inability to take responsibility for its racist past. That idea of accountability and taking responsibility, and even as that fits in the Christian idea of repentance, that seems like a big theme here, right?
Right. And I mean, let's be clear. you know, as a Mormon person, I know how our flaws and mistakes have been used against us. They've been used to humiliate us, right? And so it's very important to know that Mormonism is not unique in having a deeply racist institutional history. You know, at the same time, the only way forward is to understand and know that history, to hold it and look at it, to understand it in detail, to understand how the structures that provide us comfort do not provide the same kind of comfort for people of color, perhaps, as they do for white Mormons. And to think about how we can remake those structures so that we can all be together in that space. I think of, you know, Gordon B. Hinckley, beloved LDS Church president, you know, his interview with Mike Wallace on 60 Minutes, which I talk about in the book, when Wallace brings up the church's history, you know, Gordon B. Hinckley said, well, don't worry about that. Those little flecks of history. It's basically okay now. And that's not true. And it wasn't true. We can't put these things aside anymore.
Joanna Brooks. She's a professor of English and comparative literature at San Diego State University. Her book is Mormonism and White Supremacy, American Religion and the Problem of Racial Innocence. We'll take a break and come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West.
KUER's statewide service stays strong thanks to the listeners who also contribute to the station every month. Our nearly 9,000 sustaining members provide the most reliable source of income for the station, so we can bring you trustworthy news and information. If you value our commercial-free programming, consider becoming a KUER sustainer, with a recurring gift starting at just $5 a month, or increase your existing pledge. Just go to KUER.org/donate. And thanks for your support.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we have with us the scholar Joanna Brooks. The title of her new book gives away the provocative theme she's exploring. It's called Mormonism and White Supremacy. And she says, at most every turn in their history, white Latter-day Saints have chosen their own supremacy over their fellow black members. And the reason, she says, is embedded deep in the American version of Christianity. You say in the book that white supremacy gets a foothold and it grows through these micro political decisions that Christian white people make every day. And you say a lot of them, millions and millions of these decisions
all
every
the time.
Day. Explain that.
All the time. So as a white person, when I walk into a room, who do I make eye contact with? Do I seek out the white people in the room? Am I comfortable making eye contact with black people? Do I choose to do business? You know, how do I live my life in a world of segregation? Where do I buy my home? What school do I send my children to? Where do my taxes go? How do I relate to the police? What responsibility do I take for, you know, understanding how my government works and how it impacts black people? Like a million decisions a day. A million decisions a day either reaffirm the bonds of white identification and white solidarity, the preference for white over black, or undermine it. You know, white people are, if there is a such thing as white culture, and I believe there is, I believe it's a culture of quiescence and forgetting and the absence of loyalty, right? So, you know, white culture teaches us not to call out what's uncomfortable, not to raise our voices, stay in line and good things will come to you, right? And in order to start undoing that social system as something people can rely on to manage a complex day-to-day reality, we all have to start choosing differently all the time.
As far as you can tell, how is it that whiteness became seen as good and valuable? Because you say in the book that this idea took shape over time as, this is how you put it, as people who believed they were white preferred one another's interests over the interests of those who were non-white. And what do you mean by they believed they were white? Take me through this idea of whiteness.
Right. And so this goes back into a body of history, of course, that predates Mormonism. And a body of history that's been richly illuminated by scholars like the late Nolik Natchev, who I had the good fortune to study and work with, who wrote How the Irish Became White, Karen Brodkin Sacks, who wrote How the Jews Became White. Mm. I mean, there is no such thing as whiteness as a census box, you know, yeah. Before the middle of the 17th century about whiteness in the United States, or in, you know, the proto-United States, takes shape in the middle decades of the 17th century, when laws are passed that make servitude heritable by people among those who are seen as black. And, you know, up until that point, in the early decades in Virginia, white indentured servants and black unfree workers were in common cause. Not always, but often in common cause against the landed, right? And when that legal framework came into place that made chattel slavery a heritable condition, we see that fragmenting and fraying. And institutionally, that's when whiteness as an identity, as an idea, gains value. I mean, no one's actually white. I mean, that's the box that best fits me, but what about me is white other than my shirt today? You know, I'm olive skinned and I have black hair, but I was raised to identify, despite, in fact, you know, a complicated ancestry, I was raised to identify and understand myself as white, as being safe in white places and not safe in black places.
Yeah.
And mine is certainly not a unique experience. And so, you know, over time, we see wave after wave of immigrants come to the United States and be marginalized and mistreated, and then at some point opt into the system of privileges and preferences. If they can, if they can pass, folks do and will. It's not revocable. If you look at the high rate of hate crimes against Jewish people, you know, Jewish whiteness is sometimes very tenuous. you know, if you opt in and do not challenge the structure, you pull the lever and you win all the prizes, so-called, the material advantages and benefits, the immunity from police violence in most instances, not uniform, but, you know, generalizable, the assumption of intergenerational wealth, just so many advantages.
This is what you mean when you refer to that white people have what you call a possessive investment.
Right.
In whiteness, I guess.
That's right. I mean, so you can see, for example, even in, and I will focus in on some instances in Mormon history, although these are by no means limited to Mormon history and Mormon places. So we see in the 1950s, leaders of the LDS Church advocating for the segregation of blood banks racially, advocating against interracial marriage, organizing white LDS people to oppose the desegregation of white neighborhoods where LDS chapels were located. Whiteness has, as the great scholar George Lipset said, a cash value, right? You opt into the system of whiteness and you inherit benefits. You obtain benefits that are not equally accessible to people who are black. And it's something people guard and maintain amongst themselves by marrying within the race, by living in predominantly white neighborhoods, living in gated communities, allowing police forces that antagonize black people, participating in neighborhood net lists where we know these exist. Every time a person of color walks in the neighborhood that isn't recognized as a neighbor, the alarm goes up. There's a vast system of very quotidian choices white people make to maintain the investment in their whiteness because it provides a kind of benefit.
Let me back up to the earliest days of the Mormon movement. What did early white Mormons, and they were mostly almost exclusively white in those early days, what did early Mormons and Mormon leaders think about black people? Did they see them at all? And we'll get to Joseph Smith here in a moment. But just generally speaking, in those early days, it seems like Mormons in that early movement didn't think that differently from other white American Christians, it seems. Or did they?
It will surprise no one to hear that Joseph Smith was kind of all over the place
yeah.
on issues of race. He had planks in his presidential platform in 1844 that supported gradual emancipation, which is actually fairly middle of the road prospect, wasn't by any means a special commitment. I mean, what we see is Mormonism is defined by the absence of a special commitment to Black emancipation. So there are Black people who find their way into Mormon movement spaces, Elijah Abel, Kwaku Walker Lewis, Jane Manning James, you know, but Mormonism itself institutionally has no special commitment to the emancipation of Black people. We see this from the 1830s. We see it in the Evening of Morning Star in Missouri when, you know, the early Mormon communities in Missouri were being subjected to some pretty awful violence. And in our LDS paper, the announcement is put out, hey, okay, everyone, if you want to gather to Missouri, great, with an implied audience of white and Black Mormons, just be aware that Missouri is a slave state and we really can't offer you any protection against that, right? So early Mormon communities were not committed to Black emancipation, and you had to be in those spaces, right, to be about the equality and emancipation of Black people in the 1830s and 40s and 50s, you had to be explicitly committed to it. And there were American denominations that were. There were, you know, the Quakers from the beginning. There are Baptist churches in southern New England that refused to admit slaveholders from the middle of the 18th century. I mean, there are churches in the United States that are avowedly anti-slavery by the 1830s, 40s, 50s. We are not one of them. We make no special effort. And in fact, by the early 1850s, we've institutionalized a commitment to Black unfreedom.
You say in the book that it didn't have to be this way. But I wonder if that's actually true. Could Mormonism, do you think, have survived as an institution if they had protected Black people, if they had a higher sense of integrity about racial equality? Could they have? Because, as you say, they had this. They were sort of going from state to state. They were being persecuted. And then eventually, you tell this in the book as well, they decide to go mainstream. They stop being isolated here in the Intermountain West. And so, could they have survived if they would have adopted a different view?
I don't know.
Yeah,
I don't know. But here's why I very intentionally framed the story that way. At every turn in Mormon history, we find dissenting points of view. We find people who knew slavery was wrong and who said it and who asked their children to please do all they could to abolish slavery. We find early church leaders saying, we are acting like machines and going along with Brigham Young's theocratic vision, and this isn't right. This isn't right. To hold ourselves accountable, we have to continue to hold those moments in history where it could have gone another way, because we're going to have to make, we have to make similarly intentional dissenting choices too. We have to go another way. So I have to believe, and history gives me plenty of reason to believe, that at every step of the way, there were people who knew better and they didn't win.
Joanna Brooks, her book is Mormonism and White Supremacy: American Religion and the Problem of Racial Innocence. We'll take another break and come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West.
Public radio brings you vital information, and it keeps you company whatever your day looks like, providing moments of levity and joy along with the news. Stay connected at home. Just ask your smart speaker to play NPR or your member station by name.
It's easy to hear the news that you trust when you tell your smart speaker, play KUER. To learn more about listening with your smart speaker, go to KUER.org/smartspeaker.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Back now to our conversation with Joanna Brooks. We're talking about her new book, Mormonism and White Supremacy: American Religion and the Problem of Racial Innocence. At the beginning of this month, Dr. Brooks started tweeting out the photos of various statues and buildings of prominent LDS church leaders who also happen to be racists.
I think it's been a really interesting last couple weeks for statues.
Right?
It is worth asking ourselves, what are statues for? Why do we name buildings after the people we name buildings after? What kind of environment does that create? Why do we continue to invest meaning and invest cash in statues. Provo City Library commissioned a statue of Abraham Smoot in 2015.
Wow.
Out of bronze. So Abraham Smoot was early convert to the church, born in Kentucky, served a mission in the South, came west, arrives in Salt Lake Valley, establishes enterprises in Sugar House, and then moves to Provo and builds something of an empire. He's one of the first, what is the right word, chair or president of the board of trustees of Brigham Young Academy, at the time now Brigham Young University. He is a stake president and a mayor and runs the university at the same time. So he's kind of a mob boss. He owns slaves. He owns slaves. And it's likely he worked with Brigham Young, that his ability to own slaves was supported actively by Brigham Young, both in making Utah territorially secure for slaveholding. And mind you, the slaves were not essential to his economic enterprise. He maintained them in all likelihood as sort of house servants. And he viewed Black lives as ornamental, right? He was a man of status from Kentucky, and holding a Black person in slavery was what you did as a marker of your status. In 1879, John Taylor sought out Abraham Smoot for his opinion on something. Taylor was church president at the time. And of course, Elijah Abel's claims to ordination were being challenged and bedeviled at every turn, even though Abel had actual documentation in hand. And Taylor sought out Smoot at his home after a state conference and sat down with him and asked him to provide a recollection, because Smoot had in fact been ordained to the priesthood at the same day by the same person in, I believe, Kirtland in 1836. And Smoot bore testimony to the LDS church president that that ordination was not valid. He was there and he saw it. He was ordained by the same person, a man named Zebedee Coltrane. He bore false witness and he pressured Zebedee Coltrane, who was by then sort of a poor farmer living on the margins down in Spanish Fork, whose land Smoot actually owned. He pressured Coltrane to bear similar false testimony, contributing to the accretion of, quote, authoritative sources that would lead to the exclusion, the institutional exclusion of Black people from the priesthood and the temple. So, you know, he was quite a charismatic leader. He was a very powerful man, but the way he came to power often was at the expense of Black lives. And Provo spent, I don't know how much, in 2015 on a life-size bronze statue of him that's in the library. So statues mean something. It means something when we use money and maintain and center and anchor our culture around monuments of very flawed people, which is not to say that we're not flawed or that they should be, you know, thrown away as humans. But at the very least, they need a big old asterisk on them that says, this is complicated. Buyer beware. No. The full history.
Beginning in the early part of this month, you started tweeting about different statues and buildings, many of them on the campus of BYU, but also in Salt Lake City, that were named for noted
church leaders. In Washington, Utah.
They were named for these leaders who had these racist ideas in their past. You did this for 10 straight days. What are you saying with those tweets? What are you getting at? Are you calling for them to be dismantled? Are you just calling for people to think more deeply when they walk past a statue like that? What are you getting at there?
So, yeah, this idea came to me when I was writing the book, and I had written a paragraph or two about the positions LDS church leaders, including church presidents, took in the 1940s through 70s on various issues relating to equality, segregation, discrimination. And I wrote through this list of names, and I realized that these were all the names of the buildings I'd, you know, studied, played, slept, worshipped in at BYU. These were all right there, all of these names, from the J. Reuben Clark Law School to the Ezra F. Benson Chemistry Building to the Abraham Smoot Administration Building to the George Albert Smith Fieldhouse. They were all named. And now, mind you, these are all leaders of the church, but it bears noticing that the people who became leaders of the church were people who actively valued discrimination against Black people long past the time when other faiths in the United States did. So, what that moment brought home to me was that just like we live every day in these structures of privilege that we take for granted, many of us move every day through built environments that are completely embedded with racialized histories, with histories of inequality. We don't even see them. We don't even see it. And we have to see everything with new eyes. We have to see everything. We have to understand that none of these things are here by accident. Like Mormonism isn't predominantly white by accident. I used to think that. I used to think that it was because we were sort of goofy and, you know, there's only white people in the West. What is that about? We were so dorky. No people of color wanted to join us. I don't know. I thought we were white just because we were white on purpose. We were white because Brigham Young intentionally established a territorial theocracy where, in his vision, white men would rule over black. And he established slavery as much to keep black people out of the territory as he did to keep them as a captive labor force. Mormonism was white on purpose. And that does not square with the best of the Mormon tradition. It doesn't. So we have to see that. We have to see that contradiction. It's very uncomfortable, but these are the buildings. This is the world we live in, quite literally. This is the world we move through every day and don't see, but have to start seeing.
I wanted to ask about another sort of moment that you write about how Christianity evolves. And you have one segment that tried to reconcile Christian ideas in the Bible to the new thinking that was going on in scientific realities. But then you have another segment of Christianity that kind of stayed with a literal reading of Scripture, a literal reading of truth claims, where you have people who believe there was an actual Garden of Eden. There was actually two figures named Adam and Eve, literally the first humans, that there was an actual flood, that there was an actual ark, that the earth was only 6,000 or 7,000 years old. And I'm wondering, how does race figure in those two diverging types of Christianity? Because you mentioned that Bible-based fundamentalism held firm to the white supremacist ideas.
Right. And so this is an idea we call originalism, right? And this is a word scholars of law and theology and race use to characterize the habit white people have of saying things are now the way they are because that's how they've always been. They've been that from the beginnings. And if you're a religious person, and because that's how God made them, right? What we see is in the 19th century, Christianity starts to split in its treatment of the Bible. And part of that has to do with science, like you said. Part of that has to do with Darwin's Origin of the Species and with advancing scientific worldviews that provide alternate accounts for the creation of the earth. But part of that also has to do with slavery. There are sections of the Bible that the Old Testament specifically, in which slavery is sort of normalized and naturalized. There are slaves in the New Testament as well. And folks who supported slavery in antebellum America pointed to those proof texts as legitimating institutionalized chattel slavery. Meanwhile, there are other Christians, white Christians, who are pointing to proof texts in the New Testament, you know, love your neighbor as yourself, the golden rule, do unto others you had them do unto you, and using those to leverage away from and create a new space for an ethical rather than a literal approach to Scripture, right? That we're not going to take everything in the Old Testament as a pretext for holding black people in bondage in the United States in the 1850s and 60s. That's not square. In the 1910s, we see the institutional emergence of fundamentalist Christianity, self-described, which grounds itself firmly, doubles down on literal proof text readings of Scripture, including ones that sustain structural racism. And what's most jarring, as I discuss in the book, is that one of the people who helped publish this 12 to 14 volume set of Bible studies called The Fundamentals, which was funded by an oil company for distribution to like every Protestant church in the United States, was the brother of Thomas Dixon, who was the author of The Klansman, which was the book upon which Birth of a Nation was based. So we see Birth of a Nation and American evangelical fundamentalism come from the same place. They come from a literal reading of biblical texts and a continued valuation of any kind of mythos that privileges white over black.
And where do Mormons fit in there?
Yeah, that's a great question, because, you know, we were going through the same growing pains in our own faith. So we see in the late 19th and early 20th century, as Mormonism institutionalizes, you know, we have our first systematic theologians. You know, we have works that, you know, book-length works by, for example, John Widsoe, by James Talmadge, that present our faith as a systematic theology, as something legit and that makes sense and it has order, it has discipline. And Talmadge and Widsoe are quiet on the issue of race. Hmm. And where we see race enter is with the Mormon theologian B.H. Roberts, who was a voracious reader and writer, and who gave us one of the first institutionalized, you know, instruction manuals in the church, the course in the 70s. And, you know, again, this is an effort to systematize and to present, you know, as a coherent body of thought, Mormon theology.
So what B.H. Roberts is trying to do, because I think this is important, is what's going on in Mormonism at the time is they're creating these systems. Like, this is how it works. Here's this systematic theology.
Right. We're not just crazy people out in Utah. Like, we have a system.
Yeah.
We think this way, and here it is. We're going to publish it. It's elegant, and it's thoughtful. And yeah, go ahead.
And so B.H. Roberts has to find a system that explains the racism. And so this is when he gives Mormons this idea that black people were fence sitters in some pre-existent world. They, you know, before spirits came to earth, they weren't, and here's the key word, they weren't valiant.
Now, to be clear, that didn't originate with Roberts. That had been sort of hovering around from, I think it was Orson Hyde in the 19th century.
But he picked it up, but he spread it, right?
Oh, yeah, and he ties it to, he says that the law of the Lord on the matter of the, quote, Negro race problem is, we source it to the curse put upon Cain, and that this curse was preserved through the flood by Egyptus and passed down through Ham, and that therefore black people are, quote, a forbidden race. And among the sources he cites in this chapter is the History of the United States by Alexander Stevens, who was vice president of the Confederacy, and a book called The Color Line by a Tulane professor named Benjamin Smith, who was a biological racist. You look up the source text, and it basically is a text arguing for the innate biological inferiority of black people. And so this is how thin our rationale is, you know. Yeah.
Well, I was just going to say, what I think is interesting about that, though, to me, is that race played a really important part in the way Mormon leaders were developing theology. Like, race was a really critical part of the way they were trying to think about these systems. They had to figure out a system, and they had to fit some system in it.
Maybe. I mean, I think race was really important to the creation of a territorial theocracy.
Hmm.
I think it was really important to the establishment of an empire. And I think that we did not institutionalize and theologically square up, you know, the theological aspects of that until the 1940s. I mean, it wasn't until the 40s when President George Albert Smith released a proclamation. It was 1949, establishing that, this was in fact the policy of the church. In fact, there's ample correspondence in the archives at the Marriott Library that show that, you know, thoughtful LDS people, many of them professors of sociology, were arguing amongst themselves and the leaders of the church in the early decades of the 20th century, saying, what are you doing? What are you talking about? Race is a myth. And what you're doing, and this is the 1930s and 40s, what you're doing is wrong. I mean, that correspondence exists. And what we see is the leaders of the church keep doubling down and doubling down to protect the institution.
Hmm. Let's talk about 1978, June of 1978. This is when the priesthood ban, of course, was lifted. You mentioned in the book Mormon President Spencer W. Kimball, who was the one who made the announcement. He's the president of the church at the time. He said nothing about renouncing the policies and the ideas of the past, said nothing about apologizing for the past, didn't call for a collective sense of repentance. Where does that idea fit into the way the church has responded over time They don't want to talk about the past, or they don't want to apologize. One Mormon, current Mormon leader, Dallin H. Oaks, has talked about the fact that, I think he said, we don't apologize. That's
right.
What he said. So where does all that fit?
Well, so, you know, just as there's a possessive investment in whiteness, in the book I talk about how for LDS people there's a possessive investment in rightness and they're bound together. And we see it really, I think the origins of it, again, in the 1890s when the church is facing ruin, the institutional church is facing ruin because of its commitment to polygamy. It's been made war upon. Its finances have been ransacked. And church leaders make a choice. They make a choice to renounce the practice of polygamy, practice, not doctrine, in order to preserve the institution. And what holds it all together through this incredible turnabout, this incredible set of contradictions, is the idea that that God will never allow the prophet to lead the people astray. It's an idea that really is articulated with greatest force and distribution in that moment. Similarly, you know, that's the logic we then start using for everything that's impossibly contradictory and makes no sense, you know? Yeah. So when Larry Nelson is arguing with George Albert Smith saying, what are you talking about? There's no theological basis for this. Race isn't a construct that is recognized by scientists as having any validity or reality. What are you doing? George Albert Smith, you know, escalates the conversation to a place where he says, well, this is how it's always been. And if you continue to argue with me, we'll look at your membership, you know, against the facts of our own history. And so in these moments of impossible contradiction, it's this doubling down on rightness that gets us through. Well, that's just the way it is because it's always been that way. And we just don't talk about the things that unsettle the coherence that we'd like to believe. And again, this is an impossible corner Mormon people have painted themselves into. I mean, the idea of the infallibility of church leaders, the perfection of Mormon history. What other people of faith on the face of the earth put themselves under that kind of pressure? Like, since when are the people of God defined by being always right? Like, if you look at the scriptures, if you look at the Old Testament, right, the chosen people are always wrong. They are wrong and wrong, and then they're more wrong. And then God says, hey, guys, you're wrong. And they're like, oh, gosh, you're right. And then they're wrong again. And we've Mormons have set up an impossible burden for ourselves with our possessive investment in rightness. And no, we were right, and this was right, and they were right, and everything was right. And families have split over it because at some point, some people can't bear the contradictions any longer. They say we have to own all of who we are, and all of who we are is not okay, right? So, you know, that is why for me, you know, being wrong in public and acknowledging you're wrong and taking feedback is critical to undoing white supremacy, especially for Mormons. We have to get used to the fact that we can be wrong and still be beloved and not be ashamed, like the way that anti-Mormons and evangelicals and others would shame us. But we can feel guilt and responsibility and sorrow and be wrong and yet be loved.
You asked the question, can the LDS Church take a more intentional approach toward addressing anti-Black racism and white supremacy? And I have to say, from the book, even though it is full of these grim stories and really troubling stories from the past, I sense a hint of optimism here. You talk about there should be movement from the top. There should be movement from the margins. There should be movement from the middle. Are you optimistic about that, that this is maybe a moment of change? That does seem to be the question everyone's asking themselves right now.
When I write about Mormonism, I think about the Mormon movement. I think about the Mormon movement, and it's a big, messy phenomena that starts, you know, 1820s and has 14, 15, 16 organized branches and a million other ways and shades of being. And what animates the Mormon movement is the hunger of very common people for better. And for better, not just in a hermetically sealed hereafter, but for transcendence and visions and relief from suffering now, here, in communities that we can raise our children in. And that is the heart of who we were. And there are some parts of our goals and our motivations that metastasized and have become something really ugly, but they don't define all of us. There is so much good in Mormon people. You know, I mean, I started with a neighbor and some friends, a nonprofit, a couple of years ago, helping people who are refugees in detention and just writing letters and sending some very modest commissary. And I laugh, but my most dedicated volunteers are Mormons. I can count on Mormons to show up and do the work every time. Now, mind you, these aren't church attending Mormons. These are queer Mormons. These are less active brown Mormons. These are Mormon grad students with lots of questions. These are all kinds of funky Mormons, but Mormons know how to work and Mormons know how to love. And that gives me great reason for hope. But we have to work. It's decades of work in our lifetimes, and it will be centuries of work ahead of us.
Joanna Brooks, thanks very much.
Thank you.
Joanna Brooks, she's a professor of English and comparative literature at San Diego State University. Her book is Mormonism and White Supremacy: American Religion and the Problem of Racial Innocence. Radio West is a production of KUER. You can subscribe to the show wherever you get your podcasts. And remember, we'd always like to hear from you. We're on Twitter, at Radio West. Our intern is Natu Tway, the program produced by Benjamin Bombard and Tim Slover. Christy Miners is our executive producer. I'm Doug Fabrizio.